And now we present episode 2 of our classic serial, dramatized in 4 parts from the novel by C.S. Lewis. That Hideous Strength.
Mark Studdock, a young fellow of Bracton College Edgestow, has been introduced by Lord Feverston to a prestigious new institute, the NICE, but cannot discover what job they expect him to do or why they're so determined to buy the site of Bracton College's ancient well. Meanwhile, Mark's wife Jane has been to consult the strange Miss Ironwood at the manor at St. Anne's, for she's been troubled by dreams, firstly of an old man waking in a tomb, and then of a Frenchman in a condemned cell. On waking, Jane has seen this man's face in the morning paper in a report on the execution of a French scientist, Alcassin. And now, in a new dream, Jane sees Mark's colleague, William Hingist, being stopped in his car as he drives home from the NICE.
Now, we need to check your identity, sir.
Mine? What?
And then...
Right,
now get
in! No! No! Help me! Help me! No!
I believe most of us here at the NICE have already heard the very distressing piece of news which it is nevertheless my duty to communicate to you all. I refer to the death of Mr. William Hingist. The dreadful incident seems to have occurred in the early hours when he was found near his car on Potter's Lane this morning with his head, unfortunately, beaten in. He had been dead several hours. I imagine it will be a melancholy pleasure to you all to know that the police of the National Institute for Coordinated Experiments were on the scene of the crime before 5.
Well done.
I would like to congratulate Miss Hardcastle over this fact and on the smooth interaction between her forces and those of the state. We had all very much regretted Mr. Hingist's decision to withdraw from the NICE.
Absolutely.
I suggest we all stand in silence for 1 minute as a token of respect for the memory of Mr. William Hingist.
And stand they do for a world without end minute, in which odd creakings and breathings become audible. And behind the mask of each glazed and tight-lipped face, shy, irreverent thoughts of this and that come creeping out, as birds and mice creep out again in the clearing of a wood when the picnickers have gone. And everyone silently assures himself that he, at least, is not being morbid and not thinking about death.
Thank you.
Thank you, Deputy Director.
Mr. Wither? It's about my position here, Mr. Wither.
Yes.
Studdock.
Mr. Studdock, yes. I am delighted to see you. All the more so because I am not quite at liberty at present.
I was just wondering about my job here. Do I have one, in fact?
The usual way of seeing me, Mr. Studdock, is to apply to my secretary and make an appointment.
Perhaps I should come back later.
Perhaps. In the circumstances...
Thank you, sir. I'll see your secretary.
Hello, Studdock.
Oh. Hello, Mr. Hardcastle.
Hanging around the DD's office?
I've decided that I must either get my position fixed once and for all, or else leave the Institute and go back to Bracton College.
Look, Sonny, drop all that. It isn't going to do you any good. Come and have a talk.
And the steady pressure of Fairy Hardcastle's grip compels Mark to go with her along the passage. She brings him to her offices, filled with what Mark has already learnt to call WAPES, the girls of the Women's Auxiliary Institutional Police. Little fluffy things, small and slight and full of giggles.
Morning, girls.
Cocktails, Dolly.
Yes, Miss Hardcastle.
Don't go bothering the DDs, Duddock. You've got him on your side at present, but you won't have if you keep going to him with complaints.
That might be good advice if I was committed to staying here, but I'm not. From what I've seen, I don't like the place. I've nearly made up my mind to go home.
You're not superstitious, are you? I am. I don't think it's lucky to leave the NICE.
But damn it all, look at it from my point
of
view.
You haven't yet realised what you're in on. You've a chance of something far bigger than a seat in the cabinet. And there are only two alternatives, to be in the NICE or out of it. And I know better than you which is going to be more fun.
But anything is better than being nominally in and having nothing to do. Give me a real place in a sociological department and I'll be...
Ah, good girl, Dolly.
Oh, thanks very much.
That's my girl. Off you go now. The sociological department's going to be scrapped. The kind of sociology we're interested in will be done by my people, the police.
Then where do I come in?
I'll put you onto a bit of real work straight away.
What's that?
Alka-Seam. Huh? You know who I'm talking about, don't you?
You mean the radiologist? The man who was guillotined?
He's to be rehabilitated. Gradually. I've got the facts in this dossier. You begin with a quiet little article, not questioning his guilt, but hinting that, of course, he was a member of their Quisling government and there was prejudice against him. Then, in a day or two, a different article. Popular account of the value of his work. Then a letter, indignant, to the paper that printed the first article. And going much further, the execution was a miscarriage of justice. By that time...
What on earth is the point of all this?
I'm telling you, Studdock, Alka-Seam is to be rehabilitated, made into a martyr, an irreparable loss to the human race.
But what for?
Oh, there you go again. You grumble about being given nothing to do, and as soon as I suggest a bit of real work, you expect to have the whole campaign told to you.
But I'm not a journalist.
But you can write. It's one of the things you're wanted for.
But I'm here under a misunderstanding. I've no notion of spending my life writing newspaper articles. And if I had, I'd want to know a good deal more about the NICE politics before I did.
It's strictly non-political.
Well, how is one to start a newspaper stunt without being political? Is it left-wing or right-wing papers that are going to print all this Alka-Seam rot?
Both, funny, both. Opposition to the NICE is represented as a leftist racket in the right-wing papers, and a right-wing racket in the left-wing papers. If it's properly done, you get each side outbidding the other in support of us, to refute the enemy slanders.
Well, this is all very interesting, but it has nothing to do with me. I didn't want to become a journalist at all, and if I did, I should like to become an honest journalist.
Very well. All you'll do is help to ruin this country, and perhaps the whole human race. Besides dishing your own career.
I don't mean that I don't see your point. I was only wondering...
There's one thing I've got to say. If you do leave, and if it should ever enter your head to repeat any of this conversation in the outer world, take my advice and don't. It wouldn't be at all healthy for your future career.
Mark's appointment with the deputy director is made for the following morning. The rest of this day he passes miserably. He goes on short, unsatisfactory walks, exploring the grounds of Belbury, the ornamental pleasure gardens.
More like some municipal cemetery.
And at the back of the house, he's surprised by a stable-like smell and a medley of growls, grunts and whimpers. All the signs, in fact, of...
a veritable zoo.
At first, he does not understand. Then he recalls that an immense...
program of vivisection.
Freed at last from red tape and niggling economy is one of the plans of the NICE.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Wither. It's very good of you to see me. It's about my appointment here.
You are... Mr. Studdock, I believe.
Yes. I called on you with Lord Feverston a few days ago. You gave me to understand that you were offering me a position on the sociological side of the NICE. But what I... Really...
One moment, Mr. Studdock. You are no doubt aware that it would be most unfortunate to speak of my offering anyone a post in the Institute. You must not imagine that I hold any kind of autocratic position.
Then, sir, can you tell me whether anyone has offered me a post? And if so, whom?
Oh, there has never been the least question of that sort. It was always understood that your cooperation would be entirely acceptable, would be of the greatest value.
Well, can I... I mean, oughtn't we to discuss details? The salary, for example?
Oh, my dear friend, I do not anticipate that there will be any difficulty about the financial side of the matter.
What would the salary be, sir?
Well, there you touch upon a point which it is hardly for me to decide. Perhaps 1,500 a year? But you'll find that all questions of that sort will adjust themselves with the greatest ease.
But when should I know, sir? I suppose there'd be a contract of some kind.
Mr. Staddock, that is not exactly the sort of procedure... I have here a form which has not, I believe, ever been actually used, but which was designed for agreements of that nature. You might care to study it at your leisure, and if you are satisfied, we could sign it at any time.
Right.
Ah, the post at last. Perhaps, Mr. Studdock, you will have letters of your own to attend to?
Oh, well, thank you, sir.
Bracton College, Edgestow, October 20th. My dear Mark, we were all sorry to hear from Feverston
that you are resigning your fellowship. But feel quite certain that you've made the right decision as far as your own career is concerned. Once the NICE is settled in here, I shall expect to see almost as much of you as before.
On reading Curry's words, a stab of fear runs through Mark. He tries to reassure himself.
An explanation of the misunderstanding,
which he must write and post immediately,
will be bound to put things right.
He sits down at a table and takes out his pen. Then another thought strikes him.
A letter to Curry.
Saying plainly that he means to stay at Bracton.
Or be shown to Feverston. Feverston will tell whither.
Such a letter could be regarded as a refusal of any post with the NICE.
Oh, Guy, it's impossible.
I say, kids. How on earth did Curry get hold of the idea that I'm resigning my fellowship?
Well, aren't you?
I never had the faintest notion of doing it.
Really? I was still quite distinctly by Miss Hardcastle that you weren't coming back.
You don't suppose I'd do it through her if I was going to resign?
It doesn't make any odds, you know. If the NICE want you to have a nominal job somewhere outside Belbury, you'll have one. And if they don't, you won't. Just like that.
Damn the NICE! I'm merely trying to retain the fellowship I already had.
Take my advice and get into Withers' good books again as soon as you can. I gave you a good start, but you seem to have rubbed him up the wrong way.
I'm writing to Curry to explain that it's all rot about my resignation.
Well, no harm, if it amuses you.
You will be sure to make it quite clear to him.
Me? Why me?
Well, damn it all, Feverson, it was you who first put the idea into his head.
Do you know, I find your style of conversation rather difficult. You will come up for re-election in a few months. The college may decide to re-elect you, or, of course, it may not. As far as I can make out, you are at present attempting to canvass my vote in advance. To which the proper answer is the one I now give. Go to hell.
You know perfectly well there was no doubt about my re-election until you spoke a word in Curry's ear.
You make me rather tired. If you don't know how to steer a course in a place like Bracton, why come and pester me? I am not a bloody nurse. And for your good, I would advise you to adopt a more agreeable manner than you are using now. Otherwise, your life may be, in the famous words, nasty, poor, brutish, and short.
Is that a threat? Do you mean my life at Bracton or at the NICE?
I shouldn't stress the distinction too much if I were you.
I shall remember that. It was you who brought me here. I thought you at least were my friend.
Ah, oh, incurable romantic.
Hello there. Mrs. Fisher? Oh, do I... Oh, sorry. You're the lady who introduced me to, Miss Ironwood, aren't you? Camilla. Camilla. Yes, I'm sorry. This is my husband. Davidson, James Sutter. Hello.
This is a stroke of luck. We were just coming to find you.
Were you? Can we give you a lift? Oh, well, Well, thank you. Yes, that would be kind. Anything to get out of this terrible racket.
Off it.
Oh, thank you. Honestly, I can hardly find my way around. Whole streets have been demolished.
And it's even more difficult in this fog.
Oh, yes, isn't it horrible?
Don't you like fog?
Does anyone?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we do.
I think that's the real reason Camilla and I got married. We both like weather. Not this or that kind of weather, but just weather. It's a useful taste if one lives in England.
Where on earth have you brought me?
Yes. I'm sorry to abduct you like this, but we've something rather important to talk about. This is the wood above Sandown.
We want you to join us, Jane.
Join you?
Yes.
Let's begin at the beginning. Have you heard of the great Christian mystic, the Sura?
I think so.
Well, the Sura had reason to believe that a great danger was hanging over the human race. And just before the end, he became convinced that it would actually come to a head in this island.
He did?
He disappeared. But before he did, he more or less handed over the problem to our chief at St. Anne's. He was to collect a company around him to watch for this danger and strike when it came.
Well, that's not quite right, Arthur. He was told that a company would collect around him and that he was to be its head.
Quite. And the Sura said that when the time came, we should find what he called a seer.
Oh.
A person with second sight.
Not that we'd get a seer, that a seer would turn up. Either we or the other side would get
what?
And it looks, Jane, as if you were the seer.
Oh, please, I don't want to be anything so exciting.
No, it's rough luck on you.
I gather from Grace Ironwood that you weren't quite convinced you were a seer. Is that still how you feel?
It's all so strange and... I've had another dream since then. And it turns out to have been true. I saw the murder. Mr. Hengist's murder.
Oh, Mrs. Stuttock, you must join us. You will be our secret service, our eyes.
Oh, no.
It's all been arranged long before we were born. Do join us.
Come. Mrs. Stuttock must come in freely. You forget she knows practically nothing about us. And that's the real difficulty. We can't tell you much until you've joined.
What exactly are you asking me to do?
To come and see our chief, first of all. And then, well, to join.
Oh.
It would involve making certain promises to him. You see, he really is our chief. We have all agreed to take his orders. Oh, there's one other thing. What would your husband have to say about it?
Hark. He'd probably think we're off our heads.
Would he object, though?
If he were at home, I suppose he'd be rather surprised if I announced I was going to stay at St. Anne's. Does joining you mean that?
Isn't Mark at home?
No. He's at Belbury. I think he's going to have a job in the NICE.
I don't think that joining us would mean, at the moment, coming to live in St. Anne's. Well, anyway, that's hardly the real point just now. Would he object to your joining? Putting yourself under the head's orders and making the promises and
would
all that.
Would he object? What on earth would it have to do with him?
Well, the head, or the authorities he obeys, have rather old-fashioned notions. He wouldn't like a married woman to come in, if it could be avoided, without her husband's... Well, without consulting...
Do you mean I'm to ask Mark's permission?
After, perhaps we should leave this for a while and let's go for a walk.
Good idea.
As she climbs from the car, Jane is looking at Mr. Denniston with real dislike. All this talk of promises and obedience has already repelled her, and she sees him and Mark and this preposterous leader at St. Anne's simply as...
men. Complacent patriarchal figures making arrangements for women as if we were children, or bartering us like cattle.
She is really very angry. And so it is much to her credit that she at length manages...
I'll tell you what I'll do. I won't join your whatever it is, but I'll promise to let you know if I have any more dreams.
Oh, splendid. May I ask for one more promise?
What's that?
Not to mention us to anyone.
Certainly.
Jane, do you know the story of Merlin being buried in the Blackton Wood?
Yes, Dr. Dimble was talking about it. He's supposed to be awaiting resurrection or something, isn't he?
Well, we believe there's more truth in it than is generally supposed.
We believe that he is buried there, and that his powers are going to be vital in the struggle.
Either we or the other side will find him. And whoever does will at least have the chance of winning his support.
It is very difficult to make any sense of any of this.
Of course it is. But, I hope the dreams won't worry you now, Jane. The less you think of them as your dreams, and the more you think of them as, well, as news, the better you'll feel about them.
Yes?
I've brought back the form, Mr. Wither.
What form?
The form of contract, sir.
But I have been given to understand that you have already refused the job, Mr. Studdock. I cannot in any event renew the offer. We could not harbour a person who appears to have quarrelled with all our members in the first week. I doubt if you are altogether suited to a learned career.
And so on, working Mark into such a state of dejection that when he eventually throws him, like a bone to a dog, the suggestion of...
A probationary appointment at 600 a year.
Thank you, sir.
Mark accepts.
You must make yourself useful, Mr. Studdock, generally useful. And if you do, then I won't despair of correcting on your behalf certain unfortunate impressions which your behaviour has already produced. Good morning, Mr. Studdock.
Mark reimburses himself for the humiliation of this interview by reflecting that...
If I weren't a married man, I wouldn't have borne it for a moment.
Thus, the burden is thrown upon...
Jane.
And he is free to think of all the things he would have said to Wither.
If I didn't have Jane to bother about.
Jane, meanwhile, as the town of Edgestow falls increasingly to destruction, finds herself troubled by a new, recurring dream.
Another?
Yes. It's extraordinary that I can sleep at all with all this going on. There's almost nothing left of Edgestow now, Camilla. Filth and destruction everywhere. Even the river's choked with mud and oil and dirt and garbage.
But your dream...
Oh, yes. Well, it happens whenever I close my eyes, Camilla. I seem to be lying in my own bed, and someone has drawn a chair up to my bedside and sat down to watch me. I say someone. It is, in fact, the man with a pince-nez that I saw in the cell with Alcazan.
The pleasantest of the rewards which falls to Mark for his new obedience is admission to the NICE library. It is on the library hearthrug and between the hours of 10 and midnight that the important and confidential talks take place.
Here he is.
Very nice.
Now, how quickly can you write two leading articles, Mark?
Can you work all night?
I have done. What's it all about?
You are satisfied that the disturbance must go forward at once?
Oh, yes, that's the joke of it. You have done your work too well, Ferry.
We could not delay if we wish.
No. What are we talking about?
The disturbances at Edgestone.
Oh. I haven't been following them very much. Are they becoming serious?
It's going to become very serious, Sonny. The real riot was timed for next week, but it's been going on too well, damn it.
Yes.
The balloon will have to go up tomorrow.
Quite.
I don't quite understand.
I don't think the penny's dropped. You surely didn't imagine the fairy left the initiative with the natives.
You mean you create the disturbance?
Yes, of course. Yes.
It's all fair and square. It can't put a few thousand imported workers...
Well, not the sort you enrolled.
...into a sleepy little hole like Edgestow without having trouble. Mm-hmm. There'd be trouble anyway. So as it's bound to come, there's no harm in seeing it comes at the right moment.
This is how things have to be managed.
It's always done, Studdock. And the real thing, the big riot, must take place within the next 24 hours. In the meantime, you and I have got to get busy on the account of the riot.
But what's it all for?
Emergency regulations. We will never get the powers we want at Edgestone until the government declares a state of emergency.
And the staff must be ready to appear in the papers immediately after the riot. Mm-hmm. That means it must be ready by 6 tomorrow at latest.
But how are we to write it tonight if the thing doesn't even happen till tomorrow?
You'll never manage publicity thinking like that.
Come on, Sonny. We've got to get on with it. We'll get them to bring us devil bones and coffee at 2.
While Mark works through the night, whiskey at his elbow and the printer's devil at the door, Jane stretches out her hand in darkness, but does not feel the table which should be there at her bedside. Then, with a shock, she finds she is not in bed at all, but standing in utter darkness and intense cold. Groping, she touches stone. The air has some odd quality about it.
Dead air. Imprisoned air.
She gropes along a rough wall, and turning a corner, she strikes her foot against something hard. A sort of raised platform or table of stone. And on it, does she dare feel? A foot. A naked human foot. Dead to judge for its coldness. She knows now she is in a dream.
It is a piece of news. It'll stop presently. There is nothing to be frightened of.
The man on the slab is huge.
Bold.
With an enormous beard. And suddenly, she has an impression of someone also bearded.
But divinely young.
Someone golden and strong and warm, coming with a mighty earth-shaking tread into that black place.
What is happening at Edgestone? Do you believe this riot arose simply because Mr. Smith or Mrs. Jones found their landlords had sold their shop or allotment to the NICE? Mr. Smith and Mrs. Jones know better. They know that the Institute means more trade in Edgestone, more public amenities, a burst of undreamed-of prosperity. And they also know these disturbances have been engineered.
That's good, Sonny. That's very good.
Somewhere there are traitors. They may be religious people. They may be financial interests. They may be Jews. They may be lawyers. It doesn't matter who they are, but there's something they need to hear. The people of England are not going to stand this.
Yeah, yeah.
They are not going to have their institute sabotaged. What should be done? In our opinion, it's obvious. Put the whole of Edgestone under the institutional police.
Good!
Last night they showed what they could do. And the first thing we must do is thank God for Miss Hardcastle and her brave boys. Yes, and her brave girls too. Give them a free hand and let them cut out the red tape. The NICE is the boxing glove on democracy's fist. Mm. And if anyone doesn't like the fact, he'd best get out of the way. Meanwhile, watch Edgestone.
That's excellent. Well done, Sonny. You've got the hang of it already. That's the left paper sorted out. Now for the right.
Oh, I think that'll be easier.
Good man. You've got the authentic voice there. Of course, there's no question they'll be printed. We control both papers. But it's best if these things sound right.
Absolutely.
Now then, let's get these delivered.
After breakfast, Jane walks immediately to Edgestone. At the top of Market Street, something happens which determines her to go to St. Anne's that very day and by the very next train. For she comes to a place where a big car stands at the curb, an NICE car. And as she's passing, a man comes out of a shop, cuts across her path to speak to the chauffeur, and climbs in. She would know him anywhere.
The pointed beard, the pounce there.
The face which somehow reminds her of a waxwork. She turns instantly to the station.
Come in, Jane. Please sit down.
Take this chair.
Oh, thank you. Have you told Miss Ironwood?
Yes, Camilla has told me about your dream. A man with a pointed beard sitting making notes in your bedroom.
Yes.
Perhaps I ought to tell you that he wasn't really there. At least our director doesn't think it possible. But he was really studying you. He was getting information about you from some other source, which was not visible to you in the dream.
Will you tell us what else you've seen?
And Jane told them about her dream of the corpse, if it was a corpse, in the dark place.
So we were right about Bracton Wood.
Well, it certainly seemed the sort of place where Marion might be buried.
But in that case...
Excuse me. We must not discuss the matter here. Mrs. Staddock has not yet joined us.
Am I to be told nothing?
It would not be wise at the moment. But look at this. Do you recognize that person?
Yes. This is the man I dreamed I saw in the cell with Alcazan. And I saw him in Edgestone this morning.
Augustus Frost.
Who's he?
Are you prepared to see the director now?
Well, yes, if you like.
Arthur, you had better go and tell him what we've just heard and find out if he's well enough to meet Mrs. Staddock.
Right.
Meanwhile, I would like a word with her alone. I have little doubt that the director will see you. and there are certain things you ought to know before he does. He will appear to you, Mrs. Studdock, to be a very young man, younger than yourself. That is not the case. Mr. Fisher King is nearer 50 than 40. He is a man of very great experience, who has travelled where no other human being has travelled before, and mixed in societies of which you and I have no conception.
That is very interesting.
And he is often in great pain. If you will now come with me, I will show you to the blue room.
Miss Ironwood leads Jane up a fine Georgian staircase. The house is warm and very silent. On the first floor, they find Camilla waiting for them.
He will see her.
And as Miss Ironwood raises her hand to knock on the door, Jane thinks to herself,
be careful. Don't get let in for anything. All these long passages and low voices will make a fool of you if you don't look out. You'll become another of this man's female adorers.
Next moment, she finds herself going in. It is light.
Seems all windows.
And it is warm. A fire blazes. And blue is the prevailing colour. She is annoyed to see that Miss Ironwood is curtsying.
This is the young lady, sir.
Jane looks. And instantly her world is unmade. On a sofa before her, with one foot bandaged as if he had a wound, lies what appears to be
a boy. 20 years old.
The light of the fire and the light of the sun contend on the ceiling, but all the light in the room seems to run to the gold hair and the gold beard of this wounded man. But how could Jane have thought him young? Or old, either? It comes to her with a sensation of quick fear that
his face is of no age at all.
Thank you, Grace. You must forgive me for not getting up, Mrs. Studdock. My foot is hurt.
Do you wish me to remain, sir?
No, Grace. I don't think you need stay. Thank you. Mrs. Studdock, you have already done us the greatest service. We have known that one of the most dangerous attacks ever made upon the human race is coming very soon. We had an idea that the NICE might be connected with it, but we were not certain. That is why your information is so valuable. But in another way, it presents us with a difficulty as far as you are concerned. We had hoped you would be able to join us.
Can I not, sir?
It is difficult. You see, your husband is in the NICE.
And it's on the tip of Jane's tongue to say,
do you mean Mark is in any danger?
But she realizes that anxiety about Mark does not, in fact, make up any part of the complex emotion she's feeling. And that to reply thus would be hypocrisy. It is a sort of scruple she has not often felt before. Instead, she says,
I must do what I think is right, mustn't I? I mean, if my husband is in the wrong side, I can't let that make any difference to what I do, can I?
You are thinking about what is right. Of course, things might come to such a point that you would be justified in coming here, even wholly against his will. It depends on how close the danger is. The danger to us all. And to you, personally.
But will it do anyone any harm if I come here?
It looks as if you will have to go back. At least for the present. You will no doubt be seeing your husband again fairly soon. I think you must make at least one effort to detach him from the NICE.
But he never takes any notice of what I say. He wouldn't believe all that about an attack on the human race.
No. And you must not tell him. You must simply ask him to leave the NICE.
Don't send me back. I'm all alone at home with terrible dreams. Mark wouldn't care whether I come here or not. I'm so unhappy. Do you think a woman is to have no life of her own just because she's married?
Are you unhappy now?
No.
And for a little time, Jane is hardly conscious of anything but peace and well-being. But soon she thinks,
this is the end.
In a few moments he will send for the Ironwood woman to take me away. But does it make no difference what my marriage is actually like? Whether I actually love my husband? But I suppose you will say I shouldn't have told you that.
My dear child, you have been telling me that ever since your husband was mentioned.
Does it make no difference?
I suppose it would depend on how he lost your love.
It was not his fault. I suppose our marriage was just a mistake. What do you say about a case like that?
I would say that you have failed in obedience.
Obedience? To Mark?
To marriage. I would say that you do not fail in obedience through lack of love, but have lost love because you never attempted obedience.
I thought love meant equality and free companionship.
Ah, equality. Yes. We must all be guarded by equal rights from one another's greed, because we are fallen.
I always thought equality was the deepest thing, because in our souls we are all equal.
You are mistaken. That is the last place where we are equal.
But surely in marriage...
No. What has equality and companionship to do with marriage? Those who are enjoying something or suffering something together, they are companions. Those who enjoy or suffer each other are not. But, my dear, it is not your fault. They have never warned you. No one has ever told you that obedience in marriage, humility, is an erotic necessity for both of you. Go to your husband and speak to him. In the meantime, I will speak to my authorities.
When will you be seeing them?
Oh, they come to me when they please.
And so Jane takes the train back to Edgestone. But it is a new Jane that does so. A Jane that relishes the sights through the window. The outlined beams of sunlight pouring over stubble onto the burnished woods. A Jane that delights in the conversation of the wizened old man who shares her compartment. A Jane who reflects with surprise that...
It's years since music has played any part in my life.
And who resolves to listen to many chorales by Bach on the gramophone this evening.
And I shan't get a bus from the station. I shall enjoy the walk. What's going on? Let me off, please,
get back on the train, quick, love.
Look,
get out of the way, then.
What
the hell is happening? Out
of the way. All night, Jane tries to get home, but is forced out of her way by a tide of humanity, looting, starting bonfires, surging in great packs along the narrow streets. Then, bruised, tired, and frightened to death, she sees Bone Lane, straight and still and empty.
My last chance to get home.
But she has reckoned without the Women's Auxiliary Institutional Police.
You can't go down there, miss.
Oh, all right.
Where are you going?
Get her!
Jane Stoddock. I know all about you, honey. You're the wife of my friend, Mark. It's all right. You'll be able to see hubby again now. We'll take you out to Belbury tonight. Now, just one question. What were you doing here at this time of night?
I'd just come off a train.
And where had you been, honey? You hadn't been getting up to mischief while hubby was away, had you?
Will you please let me go? I want to get home.
You're not going home. You're coming out to Belbury.
My husband has said nothing about me joining him.
That was one of his mistakes. You're coming with us.
What do you mean?
It's an arrest, honey. Hold her tightly, girl. Kitty, get her on your shoulder there. That's right. Where had you been by that train? Kitty, Dolly, bring her here. Do you know, you're rather a pretty little thing in your way.
Undo her top, Dolly. Where had you been by that train? Where had you been by that train?
How many times Mary Hardcastle places the lighted end of her cheroot on Jane's shoulder, Jane is unsure. But somehow there comes a time when Miss Hardcastle is talking not to Jane, but to one of her women.
1:05.
What?
I was saying, Mum, it's 1:05.
How time flies. What if it is?
Well, you said you wanted to be back at Belbury by 1:00.
Blockheads! Why didn't you remind me before? Look sharp. Get the prisoner into the car now. Don't button her dress. Don't go through the town, Joe. Go on to the asylum and down those streets back of the close.
Very well.
What the hell are you stopping for?
I don't know, ma'am. I think we're in trouble.
God, can't you even look after a car? Some of you people want a little remedial treatment yourselves.
Well, come and mend the bloody car yourself if you're so clever.
We're going to have to pull him. Out we get. Keep hold of the prisoner, you. Come on.
Last person, Miss Hardcastle, to wish to interfere with your private pleasures. Oh, but really...
It was well worth trying. If I'd got out of her where she'd been, it might have been the enemy headquarters.
It was hardly a suitable occasion.
We haven't time to waste. You tell me Frost is already complaining that the woman's mind is less accessible, which means she's probably being influenced by the other side. We've got to get the girl.
But not by an arrest. If a mere arrest could have secured the collaboration of Mrs. Studdock, we should hardly have embarrassed ourselves with the presence of her husband. And your conduct after the arrest is, I'm afraid, open to serious criticism.
Oh, I didn't know the bloody car was going to break down, did I?
There have been complaints regarding your tendency to allow a certain emotional excitement in the remedial side of your work to distract you from the demands of policy.
You won't find anyone can do a job like mine well unless they get some kick out of it.
Be that as it may, the head wishes you to report to him now.
The head? What for? I've been on my feet the whole bloody night. I might be allowed a bath and some breakfast.
The path of duty can never be an easy one.
Well, if I'm going in there, I've got to have a drink.
Oh,
come on, Wither, I must.
You don't think you'll smell it?
Well, I'm not going in there without it anyway.
The head expects you for some time.
Is it in a bad temper?
My dear lady, I don't think that is quite the way which one should speak of our head.
You are to come at once.
Half a moment.
What is it? Be quick, please.
I'm going to be sick.
Jane? Jane? It's all right. How are you feeling now?
Oh, a little better, thank you.
Miss Ironwood says you can get up this afternoon, but in the meantime, you should take a quiet day. Would you like something to read?
Oh, yes, please.
I'll bring you a cup of tea.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'll run the bath for you. I'll have to get Mr. Bultitude out of the bathroom first. He's so lazy, he goes and sits in there all day when it's cold weather.
Oh, thank you.
As soon as Camilla has gone, however, Jane decides to get up. She feels that her social abilities are quite equal to dealing with the eccentric Mr. Bultitude.
And I don't want to waste any more time in bed.
Accordingly, she puts on her coat, takes her towel, and proceeds to investigate the bathroom.
I'm sorry. Oh, I should have warned you. That is Mr. Bultitude.
And that that caused Jane's heart to miss a beat and her face to turn quite white is a great, snuffly, wheezy, beady-eyed, loose-skinned, gore-bellied brown bear sitting by the open door of the airing cupboard.
You needn't worry. He's absolutely safe. Oh. Come on, Mr. Bolton, with your lazy face. Out with him. Perfectly safe, but rather difficult to shift, as you can see. Go on. Out into the garden with you on a lovely day like this. Now then, Jane, how do you like your bath?
Ah, Mr. Studdock.
Oh, yes, sir.
I do most sincerely hope that there is no truth in the rumor that has reached me that your, Mrs. Studdock is suffering from some nervous disorder.
What?
Because it occurs to me, in view of the great pressure of work which rests on you at present, that in your case the Institute might be induced, that we should all be delighted to welcome Mrs. Studdock here.
Until the deputy director said this, Mark had not realized that there is nothing he would dislike so much as having
Jane at Belbury. There are so many things she wouldn't understand. Jane in the middle of Belbury
would turn the whole place into one vast vulgarity, flashy and furtive.
Oh, that's very kind of you, Mr. Wither. Thank you. But I don't think... I don't think she'd... Well, thank you in any case.
Jane, dear. Jane, come in and sit by the fire.
We're not expecting you to do any work today. Ah, this is Mr. McPhee, who should really be trenching celery and shouldn't be in the kitchen at all. But as he is, I suppose he should be introduced.
Oh, how do you do?
I am very glad to see you, Mrs. Studdock.
Oh, don't believe a word he says, Jane. He's your prime enemy in this house. He doesn't believe in your dreams.
Mrs. Dumble, I have repeatedly explained to you the difference between a personal feeling of confidence and a logical satisfaction of the claims of evidence. The one is a psychological event.
And the other a perpetual nuisance.
Never either, Mrs. Studdock. The fact that no proof exists to confirm that your dreams are veridical has no connection with my personal attitude.
Of course, you have a right to your opinions.
Mrs. Studdock, I have no opinion on any subject in the world. I state the facts and exhibit the implications. If everyone indulges in pure opinions, there'd be less silly talking and printing in the world.
Well, I know who talks most in this house. What are you waiting for, anyway?
I was wondering whether you had a cup of tea, see a good for.
You taught it, Studdock.
What's the matter?
I can't make out what's the matter with you. Have you made up your mind to annoy the old man? Because it's a dangerous game, you know.
What on earth are you talking about?
Well, didn't he say something about bringing your wife here?
Yes, what about it?
And what did you say?
Well, I said not to bother, and thank you very
much. Well, you might have known he'd be offended. Says he's hurt, which means somebody else soon will be. Why the hell couldn't you have your wife here?
Isn't that my own business?
You're not very polite to little wifey, Studdock.
And they tell me she's a damn pretty girl.
The beech trees in the grounds, yes. I have just given orders for them to be cut down.
Why, Professor? I'm rather fond of trees.
Oh, yes, yes. The pretty trees, the garden trees. The forest tree is a weed. But I tell you, I have seen the civilized tree in Persia. It was made of metal.
Metal?
So natural, it would even deceive.
I wonder what the birds would make of it.
I would not have any birds. No feathers, no nests, no eggs, no dirt.
It sounds like you mean no life.
No, simple hygiene. Listen, my friend. If you pick up something rotten and you find this organic life crawling over it, do you not say, oh, the horrid thing, it is alive, and then drop it? Is this not why you English have invented the daily bath? It is to rid yourself of organisms, yes?
Ah, but we are organisms ourselves.
But that is the point. In us, organic life has produced mind. It has done its work. Now we should get rid of it. Slowly, we learn how. Learn to make our brains live with less and less body. Learn to build our bodies directly with chemicals. No longer to have to stuff them full of dead brutes and weeds. Oh, the beef was delicious, eh? Let us now have coffee. My young friend, I am very sorry to hear of this new trouble between you and the deputy director. If he invites you to bring your wife here, why do you not bring her?
I never knew he attached so much importance to it. I thought he was merely being polite.
Well, it is of no importance in itself. But I have a reason to believe it came not from Wither, but from the head himself.
The head?
The head thinks that you cannot really be one of us if you will not bring your wife here. He will have all of you and all that is yours, or else nothing. You must bring the woman in, too. She must also be one of us.
Well,
Come, look out the window. Look at the moon. There is a world for you, no? There is cleanness, purity, no grass, no lichens, no nothing, eh? Not even air.
Yes, a dead world.
No, there is a life there.
Do we know that?
Oh, see, intelligent life under the surface. A great race further advanced than we. An inspiration.
How do we know all this?
I speak that you may know what can be done, what shall be done here. This institute is to bring out of that cocoon of organic life which sheltered the babyhood of mind the new man. The man who will not die. The artificial man free from nature.
And do you think that someday we shall really find a means of keeping the brain alive without a body?
We have already begun. The head himself has already survived death. And he shall speak to you this night.
Is the young man ready?
Oh, yes, Reverend Speck. You are ready, are you not, Mr. Stoddard?
You have explained it to him, then. The head has sent for you. Do you understand? The head? You will look upon one who was killed and is still alive.
What the devil are you talking about?
Reverend Strake is quite right. Our head is the first of the new men. And a word in your ear, my friend. You will obey his orders.
But who is it?
It is Francois Alcazan.
He was guillotined.
See?
Yes.
You will come.
Yes. Yes. Of course I'll come.
It is the worst dream Jane has yet had. She sees...
Look.
She sees...
Great fat man.
And another.
Lamp confounded.
And Mark is escorted down passages that are strange to him.
Passage after passage.
White glossed wall. And then into a place where all the lights are on. And there are...
strange smells.
We have brought him.
He is ready.
Come.
Jane sees Mark enter a surgical-looking room with glaring lights.
And sinks and bottles.
And glittering instruments.
Strip to your underclothes.
A young man in a white coat gives them white clothes to put on, which he plucks from a glass container with a pair of forceps.
Turn on the chamber air. Not much. And not few. Slowly. To full. Now, the lights. Now, air in the lock. A little less of the solution. And now, are you ready to go in?
No.
Yes.
And Jane, in the darkness, cannot make out what she is seeing. But then into focus comes...
face.
Floating just in front of her. There is a beard, a nose, and eyes. And there seems at first to be...
nothing above the eyes. But now, as she gets used to the light, she sees a sort of
turban.
But it is a turban of brains. The top part of the skull has been removed. The brains bulge out. She sees it twitch.
Kill it! Kill it! Put it under its pain!
The mouth is wide open and quite dry. And she sees now it is not floating, but fixed up on a brick. Things hang from it.
Tendrils.
She thinks.
No tubes.
Little rubber tubes.
Yes.
They lead into the wall.
Yes.
And then,
oh.
From its mouth,
oh.
From its mouth, a puff of air. It licks its lips, working its mouth.
Oh, sister, bow to the head.
And now the saliva dribbles into its beard. Its mouth opens wide.
Episode 2 of That Hideous Strength by C.S. Lewis. Jane was played by Catherine Hulbert, Mark by Andrew Wincott, Feverston and Fisher King by Steve Hodson, Wither and McPhee by Jeffrey Banks, and C.S. Lewis by Gerard Green. Miss Hardcastle was Judy Bridgeland, Dolly, Tanis Eisen, Phyllis Strato, Roger Hume, Strake, Robin Kyle, and Alcassan, Terry Malloy. Curry was Philip Anthony, Camilla, Sean Lloyd Owen, Arthur, Andy Hockley, Miss Ironwood, Daphne Roger, and Mrs. Dimble, Tina Gray. The music was composed and played by Vic Gammon. That Hideous Strength was dramatized by Stephen Malatrat and directed at Pebble Mill by Nigel Bryant.